This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Today on the show, Matt Olien reviews the new caper movie, Ocean's 8. It's a movie about theft, and he says one of the actresses definitely steals the show. And from the Cutting Edge podcast, drones, mock crime scenes, and 3D printers bring hands-on learning to alternative classrooms. But first, it's Friday, and this is a day we normally reserve for an in-depth discussion with our news director, Dave Thompson. But he is on vacation, and so instead we are going to visit with Kara Hetland. She is the director of radio at South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and she joins me from Sioux Falls for a look at what's happening in the Mount Rushmore State. Kara, thank you for joining us today.
So happy to be here.
Let's start with politics. There was a recent primary and some upcoming conventions for the state. You want to go with primary or conventions first?
We can talk about primaries for sure. Basically, just for the Republican Party, some Democratic primaries, more for House, state House and state Senate seats, but the big ones were for the U.S. House for the Republican candidate. Kristi Noem, our current representative, is vacating and was running in the Republican primary for governor. So the House seat is an open seat. And so it was between three candidates on the Republican ticket. Neil Tapio, a state legislator, Dusty Johnson, former chief of staff to Governor Dennis Dugard, and he is also former public utilities commissioner, and Chantel Krebs, and she is our current secretary of state in South Dakota. Dusty Johnson won that three-way race in the primary. And in the governor's race, Kristi Noem, current U.S. Congresswoman, taking on Marty Jackley, our attorney general in the state of South Dakota, and Kristi Noem won that race handily as well.
And therefore won the GOP nomination.
Yep.
Should point out that there hasn't been a Democratic governor in the state of South Dakota since the late 70s. And
right.
In fact, out of 32, only five Democrats and one populist have been governor. Are people sort of already saying that South Dakota is going to get its first female governor since she won the Republican convention, or not? People aren't doing that.
They're saying we have the potential of having our first female governor. But the Democratic candidate for governor is a young man by the name of Billy Sutton. He has made a name for himself in the state Senate as a Democratic leader. He is in a wheelchair. From an accident.
He's a bronc rider, right?
Former bronc rider, and really, really high on the circuit, in the rodeo circuit, and really faced adversity and his illness, and has really made a comeback. Now, Billy Sutton, you know, in South Dakota, we call everybody by their first name. So, but he is, you know, he's a cowboy through and through. But he made his announcement yesterday for his lieutenant governor pick, and he chose a Republican woman, businesswoman. Her name is Michelle LaValle. She's from Sioux Falls, so we got the East River, West River kind of combo. But he chose a Republican. She swears she changed her party affiliation about 2 weeks ago. But she said she and Billy really align with what they believe. And I'm going to take the stand here and say that I believe that, you know, Billy and Michelle are more in the central line of thinking, more center for Democrats, more center for Republicans. And Kristi Noem is very much a hard right Trump supporter. So we'll see how that plays out in South Dakota.
I think that's going to be a very interesting race to watch.
I think it's going to be hard to go negative on somebody like Billy Sutton, too. So it'll be interesting to see how policy-based it is and how focused it is just really on fixing some of the problems in the state.
Were there any big surprises coming out of the primary?
I don't think so. I thought that the gubernatorial race was going to be a tie and would have to be, you know, decided on a flip. But Kristi Noem really went negative in the final few weeks and pointed out some decisions that bad, you know, some let's get out of, you know, peer and general and not have the same good old boys kind of attack. Okay. And I think South Dakotans believed in that. Now, Billy Sutton's going to say, let's not have a career politician at all, and let's not bring Washington solutions to South Dakota problems. So it may backfire on Kristi Noem as well.
Also out of the primaries, an amendment passed to change the language on Marcy's Law. This is sort of a broad sweeping law that provides better protections for victims of crimes. And some people have said there's been an unintended consequence here, that it's creating just too much work for law enforcement. So what was the proposed change and or I guess it's no longer proposed. It went through.
Right. So Marcy's Law really treated all victims the same and caused some strain on some county budgets, basically, is what was happening. So what it does is it the amendment narrows the scope of the victim from the original definition. And it also protects local government from lawsuits and allows some law enforcement to use some of that crime information that was protected. They need that information to help solve a crime. So it opens some things up. It really doesn't, according to the sponsors, take away all the rights that were passed and as it was intended, but it just kind of improves upon the protections and narrows the scope of who a victim is.
Because it did pass pretty handily in 2016, and then I read a couple mentions about at first there was an attempt to repeal it.
Right, but they decided to amend it instead because when the public decides something handily, I think that lawmakers should hear that this is what the public wants. And so they amended it, and it was originally supposed to be on November's ballot, but they bumped it to the primary, which, like I mentioned at the top here, it was all Republican voting. So Democrats really opposed this move because if you went to the polls as a Democrat or an independent, you could only vote on this one thing. And so it really wasn't out there. So they didn't think it was fair for just Republicans basically to decide this issue. But it passed heartily nonetheless.
South Dakota has some conventions coming up, the Democratic convention coming up this weekend, the Republican convention the weekend after that. What are you expecting out of these?
The big thing is going to be the attorney general candidate is nominated at convention, and secretary of state position is also nominated at convention. So those statewide races will come out of the convention. So for the Democrats for attorney general, I mean, this is basically a wide open seat since Marty Jackley is stepping down. So Tatwan Means, an Oglala attorney general, and she is running for state attorney general for the Democratic Party, and Randy Seiler, former U.S. attorney. He's about 71 years old and has tossed his hat into the ring. He is the front runner there. And so for Republicans, the interesting thing is one of the candidates for attorney general has to pick. He won his primary for his legislative seat. He has to choose which one he wants to run for before the convention. So that was a ruling that came down from the Secretary of State's office this week. He has to decide because back in the Tom Daschle days when he was considering running for president and running for reelection, South Dakota lawmakers passed a law you can only have your name on the ballot once. So he has to decide right now before the convention if he's going to be on the ballot for attorney general, whether he gets nominated or not, he has to decide. It's going to be kind of interesting.
Are there any little bird sources whispering any information about which way that's
going
to go?
I think he's a front runner, so I think he's going to have to do some polling among the delegates to really see where he stands.
You mentioned an Oglala Lakota woman running for attorney general. Has the state ever elected an indigenous person to that position?
Not that I'm aware of, no. Not since my time here, back in the 70s with Bill Janklow, so...
News in South Dakota, there is a recent Supreme Court ruling on the Keystone Pipeline. For anyone who's not familiar, just give sort of the main highlights of the happenings with the Keystone Pipeline.
This is a Keystone XL pipeline. So this is a pipeline that hasn't been built. We already have on the eastern side of the state a Keystone pipeline running through. This is the XL. This is the extension that is proposed to go through the western part of the state. So what the Supreme Court ruled was that the courts in South Dakota really don't have jurisdiction over the certification of the permit. Okay, so it kind of gets down into the weeds just a little bit.
Yeah.
But back in 2010, okay, the Public Utilities Commission gave the permit for the XL pipeline. And the law in South Dakota says that if this project it hasn't begun or it completed within 4 years, they have to be recertified. So back in 2014, they went back before this Public Utilities Commission to recertify, basically guaranteeing that they are going to complete the project as it was originally permitted, that nothing's going to change. And they were issued the certification. So they're fighting over should there have been a public hearing and all of those things. And the Supreme Court's like, look, they have to hold a public hearing for the original permit, not the certification, and really courts don't have a say in it. So the only thing about the Keystone XL pipeline is that it's still in a court battle in Montana and in Nebraska. So we'll see what happens in those two states. But as far as South Dakota law is concerned and permitting is concerned, it is still a go here.
North Dakota, of course, made national and international headlines because of the protest sites at the Dakota Access Pipeline, the DAPL Pipeline. Do you get a sense, did that impact any of the happenings surrounding pipelines and proposed pipelines in South Dakota? I mean, I know there was almost half a million gallons spilled in Marshall County in November of last year. Do you have a sense of, did those protests impact your state?
The decision-making process for the permits, it did not. But I think that South Dakota is preparing for similar protests, similar camps setting up if and when construction begins in the western side of the state. So they're trying to pass some laws over what you can and can't do in a calm protest, and those kinds of things in preparation for it. But it did not have an impact in whether or not the pipeline can go through.
How's the state dealing with the drought conditions? There's a heat advisory coming up here.
Heat advisory this weekend. We have a new drought monitor map that came out yesterday, and it shows about 43% of South Dakota under some type of drought. D1 conditions, mostly abnormally dry. That's what that means. Exceptional drought is a D4. North Dakota and western South Dakota are in that D1, meaning if we don't get rain soon, we're having some problems. And again, the heat advisory for this weekend, so it doesn't look like that. But if you want to flip it, Governor Dugard announced today he's requesting disaster assistance for north central South Dakota counties affected by flooding last month, where they received over a foot of rain. So Lincoln, South Dakota, and the weather changes, right? So it's something to keep an eye on, but 43% of the state right now is dry.
Oh, good luck to you. We are visiting with Kara Hetland. She is the director of radio at South Dakota Public Broadcasting. And I am really interested in South Dakota Public Broadcasting, similar in ways to Prairie Public, that it is a small population state that covers a large geographic area. We have both the NPR and the PBS programming. That's called a joint licensee for anybody who's especially nerdy about public broadcasting.
TV and radio combined, right?
But there are also some key differences between our operations. And one is that staff there is state employees. How does that work?
Well, we are a state agency. We fall under the Bureau of Information and Telecommunications as a state agency. And so we are state employees, receive a salary. But that is it. The state pays for our salaries and tower maintenance.
Okay.
Other than that, all programming and everything else is raised through on-air pledge drives and through the Friends of South Dakota Public Broadcasting, our nonprofit organization. So we answer to two boards. We adhere to state policies, but yet we, in the news department, though, put up a big firewall. The state agencies, the governor's office cannot tell us what we can and can't report. We have a very thick firewall. So we are a news agency. We are a statewide news agency that just happens to be a state agency as well.
Does that tend to impact funding? Like if you get a new governor who loves public broadcasting and then the next governor hates public broadcasting, do you see a change in that? Could they change your salary, you know?
Gosh, I wish they could for more, but no. No, because we adhere to all of the human resources, you know, guidelines and such. But what we do here at SDPB is we are also a service. We have made ourselves available to other state agencies. And so, for example, we have what is SD.net, which is an app and a website where all of the boards and commissions meetings, all of the legislative hearings, all of the subcommittees, everything is streamed live and archived at SD.net. So we provide a service as well for agencies to be transparent and to get their word out, and people can watch their commission meetings and see their agendas and have real connections that way with the community across the state.
As a director of radio, that is a senior management position. You mentioned that there are two boards. How do you like reporting to two boards?
Sure. It's just they don't see my report from one to the other, so maybe it's the same thing. But, you know, these are more not so much policy. And again, like I said, the firewall is very thick around the news department, and that's where I spend most of my time.
Sure.
So, you know, if I need a little boost in some policy language for defining journalism or enhancing that firewall, they're very supportive of what we do. Because if you don't have really good programming and really trustworthy programming, it makes the fundraising side of things difficult.
I would imagine. I'm excited to hear that South Dakota Public Broadcasting is doing a lot of expanding, and that's because there's been some really good growth recently. So there is an office in Vermilion. You kind of commute back and forth between Sioux Falls and Vermilion, but you are about to open a new office in Sioux Falls, and you've recently moved your office in Rapid City, a place that has a lot more exposure. Tell us about why you wanted to have what you call storefront locations for your radio operations.
We felt through our strategic planning a couple of years ago that it's time to be a little bit more transparent, that it's time to really embrace community conversations and community involvement. And one way to be transparent is to make radio in the window. And so we set out to find some places downtown Rapid City. We're at 4th and Main, so not far from Main Street Square. And we found this beautiful old historic building and big windows. Anybody who walks by can see the studio, and it's open and people can come in and participate. We have music events in there. We have video screenings in there. We have a conversation about called Where Do We Go From Here, which is on the third Wednesday of every month over the noon hour. People bring their lunch and sit down and just talk about issues impacting Rapid City. We webcast that, and then we take some of that conversation and then turn it around and put it on the radio. We're looking to do similar kinds of things in Sioux Falls. We're just transitioning into the new space at 4th and Phillips. We're going to be right across the street from the new Levitt band shell that is being constructed and will open next summer. And so it's a happening place of people walking by, coming in. Like I said, we're going to have a lot more live music, a lot more local music in these two spaces, and community conversation. We're moving our televised debates that we do with our candidates to be in those spaces with a live audience so people can interact and ask their own questions.
Kara Helland is the Director of Radio for South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Kara, thank you so much for joining me today.
You are very welcome. Happy to be here.
Coming up next on Prairie Public, we're going to get a commentary from one of our favorite essayists, Bruce Berg.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the North Dakota Farmers Market and Growers Association, helping North Dakota farmers, ranchers, and gardeners market their products through farmers markets, grocery stores, and restaurants statewide. Learn more at ndfarmersmarkets.org. And by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Baseball is a national pastime, and we love the grand slams and the walk-off home runs. But for essayist Bruce Berg, there's much to be enjoyed in small ball.
Ring Lardner wrote many a short story, but most will remember Ring Lardner as a baseball writer. It was Lardner who captured the flavor of the great American pastime when he wrote about a fictional character, Alibi Ike, and others who played the game with gusto and just enough hyperbole to make baseball an attraction in the days that also featured the real ball players, John McGraw and Connie Mack and Christy Mathewson. Ring Lardner was addicted to the game, as played at the turn of the century, up until 1920, when it all changed because of a guy named Babe Ruth. The Babe was identified by the home run, gargantuan wallops, and the reputation of changing the game from bunt, steal, move the runner, or what was called small ball. Ruth brought the long ball into vogue, and the power of the big swing and the home run have long been the attraction for many, if not most, at the ballpark. Lardner could not accept the change in the game. He saw a diminishing of strategy being replaced by monstrous clouts, huge swings, and strikeouts. Ruth's talents had ruined Lardner's game, and Ring no longer showed the passion for the game he once loved. Now and then I'll hear someone call for a return to some kind of small ball, with an emphasis on moving the runners or laying down a bunt, cutting down on the big swings, just making contact. But the long ball still gets the press, and small ball is left far behind. It's almost a century since Babe Ruth changed the game with the home run. And it's almost a century since Ring Lardner became disillusioned with the game. Years ago, Giants manager John McGraw was a master at the game of small ball. But today, most managers are calling for the three-run homer. I can't help but wonder, which brand of baseball is the better game? This is Bruce Berg, Jamestown.
Bruce Berg is a retired high school English teacher. Still to come on Main Street, we have an excerpt from the Cutting Ed podcast, and Matt O'Lean reviews the new Ocean's 8 movie. But first, it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Authorities continue their search for a prisoner who walked away from a rehabilitation center in Fargo. Police and the U.S. Marshals Service say 29-year-old Sean Schroeder of Dunseith walked away from Center Inc. on Wednesday. He is considered a public safety risk. Schroeder pleaded guilty in February to voluntary manslaughter for a 2017 incident. Police Chief Dave Todd says he has lots of questions about why someone with a violent history was placed in the center awaiting sentencing.
Considering the violence of the crime that was involved here, I'm left shaking my head, also wondering why this person was not in a secured facility. I do not know the answer to that. This was apparently a decision that the court made for whatever reason, and I'm not privy to that reason.
Schroeder is described as 5 feet, 5 inches tall, and about 165 pounds. He has brown hair and blue eyes. Anyone who sees Schroeder is asked to contact authorities. Cass County Vector Control Director Ben Prather says even though testing results from live mosquito traps were negative for West Nile virus yesterday, he says you can assume it's here because positive results turned up in Grand Forks and the Twin Cities earlier this week.
Our average trap count in our metropolitan area here is around like 4.2 mosquitoes on average. So within that, we might have one or two that's in the teens. But an average trap count that we would consider like extraordinary or high would be 200, 300, 400, something like that. And we've seen trap counts average out, you know, in the last decade, at least up over 1,000 at different times. So that rain from the last 10 days or so has really kind of provided some opportunity, and folks in the listening area outside of Cass County and elsewhere are most likely going to start seeing some problems here in the next 24 to 48 hours.
Prather is advising people to take preventative steps if plans are to be outside. He says the Red River Valley has some of the highest West Nile infections rates in the United States. 2 people died from West Nile infections in North Dakota last year, and 62 cases were reported statewide in 2017. And a survey from the National Federation of Independent Business finds small businesses are reporting record profits in recent months, and 27% of them plan to use savings from the tax cuts implemented in January to hire additional employees. The report comes as some economists project that larger corporations will not reinvest into the economy with their tax savings. But Juanita Dugan with the Federation says there's an important distinction to make.
Main Street is not Wall Street, and Main Street has reacted very positively to the tax bill. We know because we've been asking our members, what are they planning to do with their tax savings? And they're telling us that they're going to hire new workers, they're going to increase wages, sometimes they're going to provide benefits.
Earlier this month, the Federation reported its members are the most optimistic they've been about business prospects since 1983, but 23% said the biggest problem is finding qualified workers. Many noted that the pool of qualified applicants they typically hire from has dried up due to President Trump's tough stance on immigration. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to this discussion with the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, the gentleman who portrays President Thomas Jefferson, the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay Jenkinson. Good to see you, sir.
I'm glad to be here, my friend.
We've been asked to talk a bit about the Thomas Jefferson Hour. The show is described as a radio program in search of the truth in the tradition of Thomas Jefferson. What kind of truth are you searching for, and how does Jefferson's legacy light the way?
Well, we're interested in truth with a capital T, you know, where we are as a civilization, what we value, our perplexities, the unresolved questions that date back to the colonial period and maybe beyond. There are many windows on the truth, but one of the great windows, as far as I'm concerned, is the life and achievement of Thomas Jefferson. In certain ways, Jefferson embodies the great dream and the great perplexity of the American experiment. So that's a window we can use to ask questions. If this were just about the historical personage named Thomas Jefferson who lived between 1743 and 1826, I would have lost interest in it more than a decade ago, and I don't think our listeners would be coming back to the program week after week either. It's clearly about Jefferson, but it's in a sense more through Jefferson than it is about him, if that makes any sense.
So we hope you'll join us for the Thomas Jefferson Hour every Sunday morning at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Tioga High science teacher Sarah Klug fell in love with teaching while pursuing a medical degree. Klug credits her student teaching experience in an alternative classroom setting for sparking that love. And in this excerpt from the Cutting Ed podcast with host Tom Gerhart, we'll learn how she integrates technology into her classroom using things like drones, 3D printers, and forensics lessons that actually allow students to evaluate mock crime scenes.
And tell me, you know, some of the tools that you're implementing in terms of some of the soft skills, and then maybe in terms of the technology as well that makes this such a wildly popular experience for the students.
So they get to start the lesson. We actually bring in some officers from the Minot PD, and they kind of walk them through like, okay, this is exactly how, if we show up at a crime scene, this is what we would do. This is how you kind of analyze it. Everyone has their specific jobs. And so they go through just the basics. I mean, the rough sketch of the mathematics, like they talk about how you have to triangulate everything in a crime scene. So this is to this point is so far. And that's pretty basic mathematics skills. And then all the reports they have to do, I require my kids to write out reports as well. So you kind of get that literary side in there. But we do fingerprinting so that we have a little fingerprinting kit that they get to use. So that's some technology there. We do some blood typing. So they test some bloods. We did get an ELISA kit, so we do some of that. We do some chemical analysis, like as if there was poisoning in maybe their drink. We do some ballistics, like what angle did the bullet maybe go into the wall? And that's just some basic math stuff there too, not so much technology. But I try to build on it every year and incorporate more into it. So even like last year, I didn't do so much into the ballistics part. This year, they kind of told them about it during their little thing with the Minot PD. So I tried to bring that into the crime scene. So now they can calculate, okay, so at what angle was the bullet shot at? What was the position of everyone when that occurred? And they have to try and calculate that out. So it's they just walk in. They have what they would have in a regular crime scene. Here's the crime scene. Now figure it out. Like, who are your suspects? And what are their motives? And I make them do warrants. They meet with the social studies POD teacher, and they have to get warrants, so they have to get cleared to get into everything. So it's a very cross-curricular thing as well, and the kids enjoy it, and they really get into it, and they almost compete with each other of who can solve the crime first, just kind of like as if you're watching like a CSI, you're just sitting there trying to figure out who did it. Yeah. They're constantly thinking of it too and coming up with theories throughout, so.
Well, I think you mentioned these are real-world experiences, things they're going to remember years and years down the road versus memorization.
Yes, exactly. So when they're doing it and they're carrying it out, they're learning all these things. Like they learn fingerprinting and what that means and blood typing. And we go over kind of what is blood typing and we go over the math. So Pythagorean's theorem, how do you figure out how far away was it shot from? You know, it's not work when you're having fun with it per se. So they're having fun, but they're learning and they're going to remember it because they're actively trying to problem solve and they're enjoying their time doing it.
You also mentioned a drone camp and which sounds really exciting, a phantom drone. How do you take that kind of technology and help the kids learn?
So that's one that I've been kind of building on these last couple years. When I came here, I didn't know much about drones, just that we had a drone camp. And so then we got a drone donated. So the first year we used it, this is where the kind of that building comes in because we had a drone. I was still learning about it. So a lot of that first year, it was just teaching them. And even them, the students hadn't had a lot of background on it. So that year was a lot on flight, just how to fly it, what does it mean to fly it, and maybe a little bit of the technology. So using the pictures it can take and kind of plugging those in and they can take the aerial photos. So it was very simple that first year. And then this last year, I was trying to kind of incorporate more the physics behind it. So how does it fly? What are the kind of the rules behind flight with it? They can go on and do their 107 certification too with it. So we try to talk about like weather and climate. How is that going to affect it? How we talk about, okay, so the aerodynamics of it. Why can't we take it out on a windy day? Even simple stuff like that. Like I don't think, like kids don't realize like how simple little things like that can really affect it. So we talk about airspace as well. So we get a little bit into the airport side of it with, okay, why can't we fly higher than 2,000 feet or 200 feet or whatever? Like, why can't you fly wherever you want to fly? Why do we have to keep it in line of sight, different things. Those are all things that we kind of talk about. And then next year I have more plans for it. So really with like hands-on stuff, talking about the aeronautics behind it and always building upon every year. And I think every year the kids seem to like it a little bit more and more and take a little bit more out of it.
I want to ask you about something you emailed saying there is a lot of trial by error in your classes. And for you, as you already mentioned, and your students. But I think it's a really important thing to fail. Is that something you agree with?
I would totally agree with that. I would think that some of my learning experience, and even with the kids, they learn more out of failure. And by them failing, it's not necessarily like they failed at that project. It's just, okay, well, now what are you going to do it better? And I think that's a huge thing to get into kids' minds too, is that I think they're so stuck on, okay, well, I failed it. I don't know how to do it. That they get stuck in that. And if they can get past it, okay, well, now how am I going to fix it? It's pushing past that failure as they see it and finding the solution.
I'd like you to talk about this idea a little bit of, you have standards to meet, but you also mentioned that you use lessons that are driven by student motivation and interests, but you're able to make those work together somehow, aren't you?
Yes. I mean, tying into the kids' interests is you're going to grab them the most. And by a lot of the lessons that most teachers do, it's so easy to tie in those standards that we have to meet as teachers. So going into it, like with the forensics, I mean, there's so many different things you can tie into it. There's math concepts we can pull in. There's writing concepts we can bring in. I can bring in kind of the biology behind it with fingerprinting and blood typing. We talk about how does the blood work, and we talk about proteins and all of that, and chemical analysis. You're bringing in some chemistry stuff. So, I mean, there is, when you're building it, you're bringing in those concepts, and then you tie those standards into it. So it's more like you're putting the standard to the topic rather than saying, oh, I want to touch this topic today, so what am I going to do? And so it's more just doing the activity, and then you're like, oh, this just hit like 10 topics, you know? Right. So
I wanted you to go a little bit more in depth on the STEM club that you started, because that sounds like a really energizing and exciting thing for the students that they've really latched onto.
I let them kind of choose what they want to do, but they've really ran with it, and more days they come in on Monday morning, oh, one STEM club this week, one STEM club this week. And they look forward to something that excites them. And I think that will just carry over. So they're so used to that different mindset of building and creating, the engineering side of STEM that gets them critically thinking of, okay, well, this didn't work right away, so how am I going to make this work? Because it's not always going to work. And I think that's such a key thing for kids to realize these days too, with everything, is with how I work in my class, the kids are working through problems, they're building things. And so they're getting that critical real life, okay, this didn't work out, now what do I do? And sometimes, especially like when we got these creation crates, I didn't always know the answer. And that's a scary thing as a teacher, not to know the answer when a kid goes, Ms. Klug, this is not working. But like, I've been really go with the flow with it. I'm like, hey, I don't know. So we're going to have to either figure this out together, or you're just going to have to kind of tinker with it until you figure it out. And I feel like that's where that really that learning comes from, because they're problem solving and then they realize what it is and they remember that because they had to sit there and work through it. And I think that is something, such a good characteristic for kids, and something that that's good for them to learn, because that's going to be something that's going to take them very far in life as well after high school, is being able to problem solve.
That was an excerpt from the Cutting Ed podcast with host Tom Gerhart. He was visiting with teacher Sarah Klug, and you can hear their whole conversation by Googling the Cutting Ed podcast. That podcast is produced in collaboration with North Dakota United, Prairie Public's Education Services, the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction, and philanthropist Ted Dintersmith. Coming up next, Matt Olean reviews Ocean's 8.
I'm Scott Prebis. I've played jazz for over 50 years. You know, as a percussionist, it's never the same for two nights in a row. How do you listen to jazz? It begins and ends with the rhythm section. The rhythm section is the engine that pulls the train and adds the soul to any jazz chart. What kind of ride do you want to take Prairie Public listeners on during your two-hour show? Smooth jazz to big band to Caribbean with great vocalists and brilliant improvisers. Some of your favorite jazz musicians? Vibraphonist Mike Manieri. He has a processed sound that exploits and enhances the traditional vibraphone sound. Andy Norell. His devotion to Caribbean calypso and his passion for the steel pan influenced countless musicians, including myself. Join me for Prebis on Jazz Saturdays from 7 to 9 p.m. right here on North Dakota's home for jazz, Prairie Public.
Well, there's the fanfare. That can only mean one thing. It is time for another movie review here on Main Street. And in-house with me is our resident movie critic, Madeline. Matt, thanks for joining us today. You've been off to see Ocean's 8. How does this compare with the Ocean's Family?
Well, that's a great question, which is kind of the crux of my review. Now, it made a lot of money. It made over $40 million, so that tells me, and it tells the industry, kind of in the wake of Wonder Woman and some other very successful films focusing on female stars, that there is an audience for that. There's a void for sure. This is basically female version of Ocean's 11 with 8 instead of 11. So to give you the background, Sandra Bullock plays Debbie Ocean. That's Danny Ocean's sister. Now, Danny Ocean was George Clooney in Ocean's 11, 12, and 13. So right there and then, we're kind of teased. Is Clooney going to show up? Is he involved in this film? Is he not involved? That kind of hovers over the film a little bit. I liked the film okay, but I don't think it's going to make people forget about Soderbergh's classic, the 2001 Ocean's 11, which was directed by Steven Soderbergh. Now, this is directed by Gary Ross, who's more of a journeyman director. He did Seabiscuit, Pleasantville, some others. Soderbergh is a near genius. He is so good at directing scenes, snappy dialogue, comic rapport. He's the producer, not the director. I think that's maybe where things aren't quite as good in this film. Ross just doesn't have that way around a scene of editing a scene together the way Soderbergh can. I also think some of the comic rapport is lacking in this film that was in the original. You know, the Clooney, Pitt, Matt Damon comic rapport really kind of comes off in that film. It comes off in fits and starts in this film, and I think part of it is Bullock's performance as the leader of the group, and she comes out of prison, organizes the group, which is almost exactly the way Ocean's 11 starts. There's even revenge, which is almost exactly a plot point taken from Ocean's 11. So I think they're not really sure, Ashley, whether to go full bore into their own Ocean's film or kind of call on the Ocean's 11 franchise as well, which is all part of the same thing. Elliot Gould has a cameo. Of course, he was in Ocean's 11. The contortionist from Ocean's 11 who can fit into anything, he has a cameo. So you get hints of the former Ocean's 11, but not completely. But I think when I mentioned the comic rapport, Bullock's performance is a little restrained in this. I was kind of wanting a little more of the bon vivant comic rapport with the rest of the women. And it's there sometimes, but not completely. And especially with Cate Blanchett, who plays her right-hand thief when she comes out of prison. Despite her two Oscars, I'm not sure light caper comedy is what Cate Blanchett is best at, and sometimes I wanted a little more chemistry with Bullock and Blanchett. The people who steal the movie are Anne Hathaway. She plays the self-involved actress who's going to be attending the Met Gala. Their plan is to fit her with massive jewels and dress her by Helena Bonham Carter, who's looking for money. So they recruit her. She's a fashion designer. And then they're going to steal the jewels off her lovely neck, as they keep saying in the film, to kind of
it just sounds creepy.
Bonham Carter is always telling her what a great neck she has to kind of like pacify her and make her feel better. This kind of stuff happens in the entertainment industry where people just, you know, praise people overtly. So they're the best things in the film. Hathaway, Bonham Carter. We also have Rihanna, Awkwafina, Mindy Kaling, and Sarah Paulson as the rest of the gang. The heist scenes I still think work pretty good. How they actually figure out how to get the jewels off Anne's neck is quite ingenious. But I think overall, I don't know if it's as good as Ocean's 11. I think the main reason is Steven Soderbergh's not the director. It's not a male-female thing. It's I wanted more comedy, and I wanted Soderbergh directing.
Do you know, I mean, you kind of keep your finger on this pulse here. Do we know why Soderbergh didn't direct?
I don't know that answer, actually. Ashley, I'm not sure he did produce it. So I'm guessing he had the opportunity to direct it if he wanted to. As I said, the other thing that kind of hangs over the film, my wife kept thinking Clooney was going to show up. And I'm not going to reveal whether he shows up or not. But that sort of like hangs over the film a little bit, this kind of where is he, what's happened to him, because he's referenced by Sandra Bullock several times. There's a hilarious line where she's got a picture of him sitting on her desk, and one of the – I think it's Rihanna or somebody says, is that your brother? She goes, yeah. She goes, he's hot. So there's this picture of George Clooney. So that's kind of funny as well. But it's not a bad film. I'm glad it made a lot of money. We'll see what the word of mouth does. If it continues to have a box office success, of course, Incredibles 2 is now in theaters this weekend. So that's going to be competing. There is a market for this. I just wish the film would have been a little bit better, kind of a slow start to the film before things kind of pick up a little bit midway through.
Do you need to have seen the other Oceans movies to understand this one?
No, as long as you know that George Clooney is her brother. Okay. And, of course, we have to suspend our belief, Ashley. Obviously, most criminals and thieves we see, especially if it's like a sibling criminal gang, they don't look like Sandra Bullock and George Clooney. These are the best-looking brother-sister criminals in the history of criminals. Most criminals look like they've been on meth for a few years. You know, some of them do. We see the mugshots. So just suspend your belief and go with the fact that both of them look like movie stars, and you'll be fine. Not a bad movie, but I don't think it's going to make people forget Ocean's 11, the 2001 version.
How's Sarah Paulson in this film? I saw her in The People versus O.J. Simpson, and boy, she was fantastic.
She's good. She's the last recruit they come up with. There's, you know, you have these recruiting scenes very similar to the first film. I wish those scenes would have been fleshed out a little bit more to give me a little more backstory on Rihanna or Awkwafina, some of the characters that they recruit. Paulson's very good. She's always very good. She's a key person that kind of gets inside the Met and gets a job there. And so she's kind of on the inside trying to help with the heist. She's always very good. But it's Anne Hathaway's film. She's very funny. She's always funny. She's engaging. I really like Anne Hathaway. I've always been a fan of hers. And Helena Bonham Carter is just quirky and weird, and she can do comedy or drama. They kind of walk off with the film. I think the Bullock-Blanchett chemistry, I just wish there had been a little more chemistry and kind of comic rapport with them. And I don't know if that's the fault of the director, the actresses, or the screenwriter, or a little of both.
There's just something
missing. Something not quite there that was with Clooney and Pitt, and I'm not sure why it's not there.
You know, I remember in our discussion during the summer movie preview show that we had on Main Street a few weeks ago, you had talked about Awkwafina and how she is like this close to just being huge.
Yes.
Does this role help that?
Yes, I think it helps that. Her big moment's going to come in August with the release of, I can't remember the title of the film now, but she's going to be the lead in that film, and that could be the big propeller for her. You know, some of the characters don't have as much to do because Bullock and Blanchett are the leads. Anne Hathaway is a big focus of the film. You know, you got three Oscar winners right there. But, yeah, I think she's got kind of an opportunity to kind of emerge as kind of an Amy Schumer type, very funny. She's good at that kind of stuff. She's a little bit raunchy as well. So I think there's an avenue for her to emerge as that. We'll just see how the August film does.
All right. Well, I've got an Oscar trivia for you. You mentioned Anne Hathaway steals the show. She did win an Oscar 2013 for the 2012 Les Mis. Name the other people in that category.
Amy Adams in The Master. Sally Field in Lincoln. Helen Hunt in The Sessions.
Yep. And one more.
Was that the Silver Linings Playbook year? So it's the Australian actress, Jackie Weaver.
Jackie Weaver, there it is. Ooh. We've been to the movies with Madeline.
This summer, you can enjoy an evening under the stars at Sleepy Hollow Theater and Arts Park of Bismarck. Presenting You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, running from June 28th through the 30th. All of the Peanuts gang will capture your heart, as well as your funny bone, as they navigate the joys and pitfalls of childhood. It will be fun for the whole family. Ticket information for Sleepy Hollow Theater and Arts Park can be found online at shtap.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 15th. North Dakota remembers World War I. By the middle of June 1918, American troops, now numbering at over 800,000, were taking the offensive on their own and occupying sectors of the front in the Alsace area of France. Since entering the war, American casualties were slightly over 8,000 killed, wounded, or missing. The unprecedented and unceasing use of artillery created most of the carnage. Wesley Johnson of Sykeston served with the American Expeditionary Force in the Battle of the Bayeul Woods. Surviving his first major battle, he expressed his thoughts on fighting in the trenches, saying, "Gas and prospects of being attacked worried us practically none at all, but artillery was hell on earth. At first, when a shell came along, we would poke up our heads to see where it lighted. It was, in our opinion, a disgrace to duck. When one of our officers fell flat when a shell came over, it was great sport." But as the casualties grew, Johnson said the attitude changed, saying, "Toward the last, we would crowd the bottom of the trench to the limit. Not a piece of paper could have separated any of us from the ground. As to how we felt, I don't believe there is anything I have yet experienced more terrible." Peter Nelson, a lad from Buchanan, North Dakota, wrote of the gas attacks in a letter home, "Dearest mother, father, and all, am making an effort at last to get a few words to you. I shouldn't be doing this now because everything is a blur before my eyes. It is a week ago since we all got into the glorious mix-up. The Huns bombarded us for 4 hours with all they had. And in the course of events, I took a small quantity of gas. It sure is terrible stuff, for it blinded me for 4 days. I don't know when my eyes will be as they were before." Noting the death of his friend, Corporal Ernest Robertson, Peter reflected, "But to look at the matter from a different standpoint, I consider myself lucky because I suffered very little from body burns and gas in my lungs. Poor Squeak has given his life to the cause for which we are fighting. Killed instantly by a shell. Mother, I can imagine the sorrow it will cause." The North Dakota boys had behaved bravely as they ended their first major offensive. The timely introduction of American forces had helped stem the massive German advance. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jim Davis. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
We'll follow reaction to the Justice Department's report criticizing James Comey, and we'll hear about another report done for the NFL Players Association on domestic violence in pro football. That study is still secret.
We turned that report in 2 years ago now, and it has sat on a shelf ever since.
We'll hear from the co-author Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow morning right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Coming up Monday on the show, we're going to visit with Molly Ye. She grew up in Chicago. She went to college in New York City. She studied percussion. So, of course, you can guess what happens next. She moves to a small farm in rural Minnesota, starts a food blog, writes a cookbook, and now she's got her very own show on the Food Network. And we're going to learn all about Girl Meets Farm coming up Monday on Main Street at 3 Central, 2 Mountain.